This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Aiti, written and performed by Roxanne Gay.
Motherfuckers. Gerard spends his days thinking about the many reasons he hates America that include but are not limited to the people, the weather, especially the cold, and having to drive everywhere and having to go to school every day. He is 14. He hates lots of things. On the first day of school, as he and his classmates introduce themselves, Gerard stands, says his name, quickly sits back down, and stares at his desk, which he hates. "You have such an interesting accent," the teacher coos. "Where are you from?" He looks up. He is irritated. "Haiti," he says. The teacher smiles wildly. "Say something in French." Gerard complies. "Je te déteste," he says. The teacher claps excitedly. She doesn't speak French. Word spreads through school quickly, and soon Gerard has a nickname. His classmates call him HBO. It is several weeks until he understands what that means. Gerard lives with his parents in a two-bedroom apartment. He shares his room with his sister and their cousin Edie. They do not have cable television, but Edie, who has been in the States for several months longer than Gerard, lies and tells him that HBO is Home Box Office, a TV channel that shows Bruce Willis movies. Gerard hates that they don't have cable, but loves Bruce Willis. He is proud of his nickname. When the kids at school call him HBO, he replies, "Yippee-ki-yay." Gerard's father does not shower every day because he has yet to become accustomed to indoor plumbing. Instead, he performs his ablutions each morning at the bathroom sink and reserves the luxury of a shower for weekends. Sometimes Gerard sits on the edge of the bathtub and watches his father because it reminds him of home. He has the routine memorized. His father splashes his armpits with water, then lathers with soap, then rinses, then draws a damp washcloth across his chest, the back of his neck, behind his ears. His father excuses Gerard, then washes between his thighs. He finishes his routine by washing his face and brushing his teeth. Then he goes to work. Back home, he was a journalist. In the States, he slices meat at a deli counter for 8 hours a day and pretends not to speak English fluently. In the second month of school, Gerard finds a bag of cheap colognes in his locker. "For HBO" is written on the front of the bag in large block letters. It is a strange gift, he thinks, and he hates the way the bag smells, but he takes it home. Edie rolls his eyes when Gerard shows his cousin his gift, but takes one of the bottles of cologne. His girlfriend will enjoy it. "Those motherfuckers," Edie says. He is far more skilled at cursing in English. Then, Edie explains what HBO means. Gerard clenches his fists. He decides that he hates each and every motherfucker he goes to school with. The next morning, he applies cologne so liberally that it makes his classmates' eyes water. When they call him HBO, he adds a little something extra to his yippee-ki-yay. About my father's accent. He knows it's there. He knows it's thick, thicker even than my mother's. He's been on American soil for nearly 30 years, but his voice sounds like Port-au-Prince. The crowded streets, the blaring horns, the smell of grilled meat and roasting corn, the heat, thick and still. In his voice, we hear him climbing coconut trees, gripping the trunk with his bare feet and sandy legs, cutting coconuts down with a dull machete. We hear him dancing to compa, the palm of one hand resting against his belly, his other hand raised high in the air as he rocks his hips from side to side. We hear him telling us about Toussaint Louverture and Henri Christophe and the pride of being first free black. We hear the taste of bitterness when he watches the news from home or calls those left behind. When we, my brothers and I, mimic him, he smiles indulgently. Before every vowel and H, at the end of every plural, no S. "You make fun, but you understand me perfectly, don't you?" he says. We nod. We ask him to say American Airlines. We gasp for air when he gives in. For many years, we didn't realize our parents had accents, that their voices sounded different to unkind American ears, All we heard was home. Then the world intruded. It always does. Voodoo Child. When my college roommate learns I am Haitian, she is convinced I practice voodoo thanks to the internet in the hands of the feeble-minded. I do nothing to dissuade her fears, even though I was raised Catholic and have gained my inadequate understanding of voodoo from the Lisa Bonet movie that made Bill Cosby mad at her, as if he had the nerve to be mad at anyone about anything. In the middle of the night, I chant mysteriously, light candles. By day, I wear red and white, paint my face, dance possessed. I leave a doll on my desk. It looks just like my roommate. The doll is covered with strategically placed pins. I like fucking with her. She gives me the bigger room with the better dresser. She offers to take my tray to the dish room and the dining hall. We take the bus to Manhattan to shop and dance and drink and hook up with dirty New York boys. I am the devil she knows. As we emerge from Grand Central, a large, older woman runs up to me, grabs my arm, starts bowing furiously. My mother always told me, back away slowly from crazy people. They are everywhere. When she first came to the States, she had to live in the worst part of the Bronx, the part of that borough that burned beyond recognition. She hasn't yet recovered. There, in front of Grand Central, my roommate clung to my arm, her fingers digging deep, drawing blood, as if I were better equipped to handle the situation. As we backed away, I realized the woman was speaking in Creole. I didn't know her, but I knew her. Qui ça ouvre, I asked her. She told me I was a famous mambo. She said it was such a pleasure to see me in America. She grabbed my wrists. She kissed my palms, held them to her cheeks. She wanted, I think, to be blessed. I was still imagining all the dirty New York boys my roommate and I would later find. There is no E in zombie, which means there can be no you or we. First, a primer. Things Americans do not know about zombies. They are not dead, they are near death. There's a difference. They are not imaginary. They do not eat human flesh. They cannot eat salt. They do not walk around with their arms and legs locked stiffly. They can be saved. How you pronounce zombie? Zombie. You have to feel it in the roof of your mouth. Let it vibrate. Say it fast. The M is silent. Sort of. How to make a zombie? You need a good reason. A very good reason. You need a pufferfish and a small sample of blood and hair from your chosen candidate. Now, instructions. Kill the pufferfish. Don't be squeamish. Extract the poison. Just find a way. Allow it to dry. Grind it with the blood and hair to create your coup de poudre. A good chemist can help. Blow the powder into the candidate's face. And wait. Now, a love story. Micheline Bernard always loved Lionel Desormeaux. Their parents were friends, though that bonhomie had not quite carried on to the children. Micheline and Lionel went to primary and secondary school together, had known each other all their lives. When Lionel looked upon Micheline, he was always overcome with the vague feeling he had seen her somewhere before, while she was overcome with the precise knowledge that he was the man of her dreams. In truth, everyone loved Lionel Desormeaux. He was tall and brown with high cheekbones and full lips. His body was perfectly muscled, and after a long day of swimming in the ocean, he would emerge from the salty water, glistening. Micheline would sit in a cabana, invisible. She would lick her lips and she would stare. She would think, "Look at me, Lionel." But he never did. When Lionel walked, there was an air about him. He moved slowly, but with deliberate steps, and sometimes, as he walked, people swore they could hear the bass of a deep drum. His mother, who loved her only boy more than any other, always told him, "Lionel, you are the son of Louverture." He believed her. He believed everything his mother ever told him. Lionel always told his friends, "My father freed our people. I am his greatest son. In Port-au-Prince, there were too many women. Micheline knew competition for Lionel's attention was fierce. She was attractive, petite. She wore her thick hair in a sensible bun. On weekends, she would let that hair down, and when she walked by, men would shout, "Quelle belle paire de jambes!" What beautiful legs! And Micheline would savor the thrilling taste of their attention. Most Friday nights, Micheline and her friends gathered at Oasis, a popular nightclub on the edge of the Bel Air slum. She drank fruity drinks and smoked French cigarettes and wore skirts revealing just the right amount of leg. Lionel was always surrounded by a mob of adoring women. He let them buy him rum and cokes and always sat at the center of the room wearing his pressed linen slacks and dark t-shirts that showed off his perfect, chiseled arms. At the end of the night, he would select one woman to take home, bed her thoroughly, and wish her well the following morning. The stone path to his front door was lined with the salted tears and soiled panties of the women Lionel had sexed, then scorned. On her birthday, Micheline decided she would be the woman Lionel took home that night. She wore a bright sundress, strapless. She dabbed perfume everywhere she wanted to feel Lionel's lips. She wore heels so high her brother had to help her into the nightclub. When Lionel arrived to hold court, Micheline made sure she was closest. She smiled widely and angled her shoulders just so and leaned in so he could see everything he wanted to see of her ample cleavage. At the end of the night, Lionel nodded in her direction. He said, "Tonight, my dear Micheline, you will know the affections of Louverture's greatest son." In Lionel's bed, Micheline fell deeper in love than she thought possible. Lionel knelt between her thighs, gently massaging her knees. He smiled luminously, casting a bright shaft of light across her body. Micheline reached for Lionel, her hands thrumming as she felt his skin. When he was inside her, she thought her heart might stop, it seized so painfully. He whispered in her ear, his breath so hot it blistered her. He said, "Everything on this island is mine. You are mine." Micheline moaned. She said, "I am your victory." He said, "Yes, tonight you are." As he fucked her, Micheline heard the bass of a deep drum. The following morning, Lionel walked Micheline home. He kissed her chastely on the cheek. As he pulled away, Micheline grabbed his hand in hers, pressing a knuckle with her thumb. She said, "I will come to you tonight." Lionel placed one finger over her lips and shook his head. "My dear, we have already had our night." Micheline was unable to rise from her bed for a long while. She could only remember Lionel's touch, his words, how the inside of her body had molded itself to him. Her parents sent for a doctor, then a priest, and finally a mambo, which they were hesitant to do because they were a good Catholic family. But the sight of their youngest daughter lying in bed perfectly still, not speaking, not eating, was too much to bear. The mambo sat on the edge of the bed and clucked. She held Micheline's limp wrist. She said, "Love?" And Micheline nodded. The mambo shooed the girl's parents out of the room and they left, overjoyed that the child had finally moved. The mambo leaned down, got so close Micheline could feel the old woman's dry lips against her ear. When the mambo left, Micheline bathed, dabbed herself everywhere she wanted to feel Lionel's lips. She went to Oasis and found Lionel at the center of the room, holding a pale young thing in his lap. Micheline pushed the girl out of Lionel's lap and took her place. She said, "We have had our night, but we deserve one more." And Lionel remembered her exquisite moans and the strength of her thighs, and how she looked at him like the conquering hero he knew himself to be. They made love that night, and Micheline was possessed. She dug her fingernails into his back until he bled. She locked her ankles in the small of Lionel's back and sank her teeth into his strong shoulder. There were no sweet words between them. Micheline walked herself home before he woke. She went to the kitchen and filled a mortar and pestle with blood from beneath her fingernails and between her teeth. She added a few strands of Lionel's hair and a powder the mambo had given her. She ground these things together and put the coup de poudre, as it was called, into a silk sachet. She ran back to Lionel's, where he was still sleeping, opened her sachet, paused. She traced the edge of his face, kissed his forehead, then blew her precious powder into his face. Lionel coughed in his sleep, then stilled. Micheline undressed and stretched herself alongside his body, sliding her arm beneath his. As his body grew cooler, she kissed the back of his neck. They slept entwined for 3 days. Lionel's skin grew clammy and gray. His eyes hollowed. He began to smell like soil and salt wind. When Micheline woke, she whispered, "Turn and look at me." Lionel slowly turned and stared at Micheline, his eyes wide open, unblinking. She gasped at his appearance, how his body had changed. She said, "Touch me," and Lionel reached for her with a heavy hand, pawing at her until she said, "Touch me gently." She said, "Sit up." Lionel slowly sat up, listening from side to side, until Micheline steadied him. She kissed Lionel's thin lips, his fingertips. His cold body filled her with a sadness she could hardly bear. She said, "Smile," and his lips stretched tightly into something that resembled what she knew of a smile. Micheline thought about the second silk sachet, the one hidden beneath her pillow between the pages of her Bible, the sachet with a powder containing the power to make Lionel the man he once was, tall, vibrant, the greatest son of Louverture, a man who filled the air with the bass of a deep drum when he walked. She made herself forget about that power. Instead, she would always remember that man. She pressed her hand against the sharpness of Lionel's cheekbone. She said, "Love me." Sweet on the Tongue. My grandmother, 87, has changed the name of the nurse's aide who tends to her. She didn't like the woman's real name, said it tasted strange in her mouth. She calls the aide Maria, so now we all call the nurse's aide Maria, too. Maria tells me this story when I meet her while visiting my grandmother, who lives with my aunt, next door to another aunt, and down the street from more aunts and a few uncles. When we meet, I tell her I already know everything there is to know about her. Information travels at alarming speed through the intricate gossip network of our family. She says, "I could say the same." The way she looks at me makes me uncomfortable. She looks at me the way a man might. I'm visiting because my grandmother told my mother she didn't want to die without seeing her youngest granddaughter one last time. She makes such pronouncements with regularity. She has been dying for nearly 20 years, but no one lives forever. Maria has a big ass. My grandmother tells Maria this regularly. She has reached that age where she lacks tact. Despite my grandmother's concern about the size of Maria's ass and her unwillingness to call Maria by her given name, they get along quite well. Maria treats my grandmother like her own. She brushes my grandmother's thin silver hair each night before bed. They love to argue about the shows they watch. They talk about the islands where they were born, the warmth of suns they once knew. On the first night, my grandmother falls asleep watching the evening news. News of war exhausts her. Maria and I smoke in the small backyard, leaning against a brick wall. My grandmother was not incorrect in her evaluation of Maria's ass, but Maria is attractive, not much older than me, dark brown skin, white teeth, soft, sweet-smelling skin. I ask for her real name and she waves a hand limply. "Just call me Maria." Her accent is familiar. The evening is cold, a cold to which our island skin is not accustomed. It hurts to breathe too deeply. When Maria exhales, I inhale. "Do you like this kind of work?" I ask. Maria shrugs, ashes her cigarette. I can no longer see the edges of her face. She steps closer, leans in until I can feel her breasts against mine. "Do you like your kind of work?" My cheeks warm. We fall into a routine over the next several days. When Maria is ready to smoke, she taps my shoulder, lets her fingers rest too long, and I follow her outside. She asks about my life. I can see my family's fingers on her questions. I am vague in my replies. On Friday, Maria gathers her things while the night nurse, a far less congenial woman, settles in front of the television next to my aunt, who is half asleep, her lower lip hanging wetly. Maria nods toward the front door and I follow. On the stoop, she says, "I cook," and I say, "I eat." She presses a tightly folded piece of paper into the palm of my hand. Maria's address is written in block letters and numbers, even her sixes and nines. When I arrive, my fingertips are numb. Maria has changed from scrubs into a denim skirt and a red silk camisole. I stand awkwardly in the hallway, my hands tucked into my armpits. "You don't have to feed me. This isn't part of your job." Maria cocks her head. She walks away and I follow dumbly. The apartment is small but clean. The walls are heavy with pictures, many of them black and white. We walk down a long hallway to the kitchen where the air is thick and hot. My pores open hungrily. "Can I do anything to help?" Maria arches an eyebrow but shakes her head. She points to an empty chair and I sit, shrugging out of my jacket. I do not visit my family often. Already I am exhausted, so many of them, so demanding, pulling me into meaty embraces and age-old petty squabbles. I live in Los Angeles, in a large loft apartment with a man, Campbell, who works a great deal. He is an agent. He takes care of a select group of clients, all of them stupidly famous. He makes them a stupid amount of money, so he makes a stupid amount of money. We are married, and our marriage is complicated but good, better than good. When he proposed, he said he understood me. He said all he would ever ask of me is to love him. I do. I don't do anything in the way of compensated work, even though I have several degrees that make my lifestyle seem ridiculous at best. 5 days a week, I volunteer at a clinic where the people think me far better than I am. Sometimes, Campbell comes home late and I hand him a gin and tonic. We talk about his day. I ask him if he wants a break, if he wants me to help him shoulder the burden of our life together. He squeezes my shoulder and kisses me and takes a long sip of his drink and kisses me again. He says he wants to take care of me. I met Campbell in the emergency room. He was harried, typing furiously on his phone while standing next to one of his clients, a tabloid bad boy actor who lay on his side, moaning softly. When the actor rolled onto his back, I could see the large bump on his forehead and next to it, a deep laceration. He reeked of booze. It had been a long shift full of crazy. The last thing I wanted to deal with was a drunken actor. You've treated one, you've treated them all. I snapped on a pair of gloves and I began examining my patient. He made a lewd comment and I slapped his wrist. Three nurses hovered, tittering nervously. I looked up, glaring, but they couldn't help themselves. I finally had to tell them I didn't need their help and close the curtain. Campbell looked up. He had gray eyes. I thought, I've never seen a black man with gray eyes before, but then he opened his mouth. "Look, Doc," he said, "if possible, I'd like you to just patch him up, get some fluids in him, and we'll be on our way. No records, no charts." My eyes narrowed. "Doc, that's not how hospitals work." Campbell came around to my side of the bed. He was very tall. He looked down. I held his gaze. He squeezed my arm. "Just play ball, sister. You know how it works in this town." I pulled my arm free. "I'm not your sister. I'm not from this town. I'm afraid I have no idea how it works." The actor started braying. Hours later, I was at the nurse's station, paperwork, always so much paperwork. I was tired and ready to go home, ready to change out of my scrubs, ready for a long, hot shower. I felt a tap on my shoulder. I looked up and saw Campbell staring at me. I stood ready with sharp words. He held his hands up. "I come in peace. I offer truce." I put my hands on my hips. "Your client will be here overnight, at least, but he's off my service. Visiting hours start at 10. I turned to return to my paperwork. Campbell leaned against the desk, crossing his ankles. "So," he said, "what will it take to see you out of scrubs?" I didn't look up. "Nothing you could possibly offer." He exhaled loudly and started walking away, but he muttered something under his breath. It wasn't nice. I heard that, I shouted after him. Weeks later, I was on an overnight shift, 2 in the morning, quiet, sitting in the resident's lounge. I had forgotten about the bad boy actor and his agent. I studied the container of yogurt in my hand, long expired. I ate it anyway, knowing the worst of what could happen. Campbell entered and I looked up, spoon in my mouth. You can't be in here, I said after I swallowed. If I can't see you out of scrubs, I will console myself by seeing you in scrubs. I tried not to appear flustered. Your client has long been released. I can't imagine what more I can do for you. Campbell handed me his card. You can go out with me. I held the card up to the light. Is this supposed to be an incentive? I tossed the card back toward his chest and he caught it, laughing. What is with you? I'm a humorless resident who works 90 hours a week. And what do you do with the other 78 hours of the week? I sleep, alone. Campbell nodded, rubbing his chin, then sat down on the couch, crossing his long legs. This presents a challenge. If you work 90 hours a week and sleep for the other 78, that doesn't leave room for much. I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you want. Am I supposed to throw myself at you now? He patted the empty space next to him. That would be a start. I moved to a chair on the other side of the room. Let's say I went out with you. You'd wine and dine me, maybe take me to a fancy movie premiere, introduce me to shiny people in magazines. We'd sleep together, I'd be deeply unsatisfied, we might go at it a few times more, and then you'd grow bored because I have a brain. We'd be right back where we started. Let's don't, and say we did. Campbell was leaning forward now, his elbows on his knees. Your anger is fascinating. Why do men always assume women are angry when they are honest? I'm not angry. He stood. You've given me a lot to think about. He disappeared. His visits became so frequent, they grew into a source of amusement in the ER. My co-workers took bets on how long it would take for me to agree to go out with Campbell. I called him a stalker. He told me I was adorable. I said he was a condescending asshole. He agreed, genially. A month passed. For 2 days, he didn't show up. I spent my entire shift snapping at the nurses, unable to soothe the line of frustration running through me. The next day, when Campbell did show up, I gave him a colder shoulder than usual. You missed me, didn't you? He asked. I was in the lounge studying an X-ray, a broken leg I would set shortly. I have no idea what you're talking about. He took the X-ray from me. The nurses tell me you've been very short-tempered since we last saw each other. Only a man with your arrogance could think that had anything to do with you. His smile widened. So it's true. I grabbed my X-ray back and accidentally cut myself on the edge. I winced, jumping around as I sucked on the cut. Let me see that, you big baby, Campbell said. I extended my arm reluctantly. He held my wrist gently, twisting it from side to side to study my finger. He disappeared for a moment, and when he returned, he had a band-aid which he applied. He kissed my fingertip and said, I was out of town on business, film festival, Utah. As I studied his handiwork, he said, You should see me for a follow-up, dinner, away from here. I nodded absently. Sure. He pumped his fist over his head, and I realized what I had just done. The chief resident won the pool at 47 days. On our first date, we sat in a bistro in downtown L.A. I studied Campbell's hairline, graying in that terribly appealing way men enjoy. He is older than me by a decade, was married and divorced by the time we met. He started talking about his marriage. I leaned across the table and pressed 2 fingers against his lips. Let's not do that. Let's not sit here and tell each other everything there is to know about who we once loved. I am tired of listening to men talk about their regrets. Campbell's eyes widened and he burst out laughing. What the fuck? Do you really want to know about the last man or three I slept with or loved? He leaned back, lacing his fingers behind his head. No, he finally said. I really don't. The night just got way better, didn't it? Before he could answer, the waiter interrupted, pen at the ready for our order, and Campbell didn't stop staring at me as he told the waiter he wanted the clams. After a lazy meal and a movie, he walked me to my door and stood real close. I must admit, you've thrown me off my game. Good, I said. I leaned in and bit his lower lip, then let myself into my house. I had not realized we were holding hands. On our second date, Campbell told me he had someone he wanted me to meet. We pulled up to the Palm, and the valet greeted Campbell by name, said his usual table was ready. As Campbell held the door for me, he brushed his hand against the small of my back. We were escorted to a table at the center of the room, a room filled with the thin, beautiful people who typically populate Los Angeles. Some were more recognizable than others. Many of the women shared the same face. At our table, a gorgeous woman was already seated. As I sank into my chair, I recognized her as a movie star having a very good year, or at least that's what people told me. During lulls in the hospital, I often sat in the waiting room reading the magazines abandoned there. It was the only way I knew anything about anything. She extended a long, willowy arm. "Your hands are ridiculously soft," I said. She grinned. "The blood of virgins is the best moisturizer." I pretended to make a note on the tablecloth. "I'll keep that in mind." Campbell cleared his throat. "Therese, this is Melinda, a dear friend and client. Melinda, Therese, a new friend, but not a client." We nodded and I buried my head in the menu, a large leather affair. Campbell looked at me over the top of his menu. "Everything is good here." "If I ate meat, I'm sure it would be." He looked so uncomfortable, I almost felt sorry for him. "Dear God, you're a vegetarian?" "If you had been paying attention, you might know that." His voice lowered. "I am paying attention." Suddenly, his phone rang. He raised a finger in the air and stepped away from the table to answer the call. Melinda set her menu down. "He wasn't kidding. You are different. Some say. You know he invited me here to impress you." I nodded. "Is it working?" "Not even a little." A waiter delivered a bottle of chilled champagne to the table. After he poured, Melinda and I raised our glasses and smiled. Maria says everyone is proud to have a doctor in the family, as she sets a plate in front of me. Chicken and sauce, rice and peas. I don't tell her I'm a vegetarian. The skin of the meat glistens. I swallow my nausea and pull my hair into a ponytail. We are silent as we eat. The meat is salty and tender, breaking apart against my teeth. When we finish, I take the plates to the sink, wash them. "I volunteer instead of working at a practice or hospital," I say. Maria laughs. "A doctor is a doctor is a doctor." We take a bottle of Merlot into the living room. The more wine we drink, the more her accent thickens. Mine does, too. "Why did you become a doctor?" she asks. "When you're willing to give over so much of your life to a single impossible pursuit, the questions are inevitable." I tell Maria the truth. We sit so close, our thighs touch. I am dizzy, my mouth empty but full. "Your grandmother says you haven't been home since..." I shake my head. "Don't." Maria sighs. "It must have been horrible." I twist my wedding rings back and forth and think about my husband, how when we're sitting together, he doesn't force me to talk. I worry I am too quiet for him. He says I speak when I need. I speak when it matters. "Your family wishes you would talk," Maria says. I pour myself another glass of wine, drink it quickly, and refill my glass again. "I'm sure they talk enough without me. Is this why you asked me here?" Maria shakes her head, her lips turning down slightly, but I am not convinced. "I do not mean to upset you. I just wanted you to know I know." I laugh coarsely and tip my wine glass toward her. "What do you think you know?" Home is an island in the Caribbean. Some call it a jewel. Everyone who leaves the place calls it home, though few of us actually want to be there, not the way it is now. I used to return regularly, often with my mother, holding her hand as the plane descended from the clouds so fast it felt like we would fall into the blue salt of the water. A narrow curve of land would suddenly appear, and the plane would reach for the ground as everyone breathed a sigh of relief. My father never left the island. He says it is too much to ask a man to leave the only home he has ever known. My parents see each other when they want. They are still married, though my father also has a young girlfriend, Roselyne, with whom he has two young boys who call my mother and their mother Mama. Somehow, it works. My mother has a boyfriend, too, but he is age-appropriate. My father owns a small architecture firm, does reasonably well for himself. As a father, he does reasonably well by his children. We are close. Maria opens another bottle of wine. Why did you leave your island, I ask. People who leave islands always bring a complex mythology. She smiles. Why does anyone leave such places? Her manner is infuriating. I look at the clock on the cable box, the green numbers blinking steadily. I should go. Maria touches my thigh. You should stay. My husband and I married beneath a gauzy canopy on the beach in my country. He wore a tan linen suit with a pink tie. His face was flushed, sweat trembling along his hairline as he tried to adjust to the island heat. The bride wore white, a long sleeveless dress. My feet were bare, much to my mother's chagrin. The air was thick with salt and the sand burned beneath our feet. We held hands and stared at each other as we exchanged our vows. He surprised me by saying his vows in my mother tongue, his mouth trying so hard to make those words right. Though I swore I wouldn't, I cried and smiled so hard my face ached for days. That night, I would carefully massage Caladryl into the skin of his face and whisper sweetly to him. Melinda sat in the front row with her co-star from the movie she was filming. Thickly muscled men in dark suits quietly patrolled the beach to keep the paparazzi away. At the reception, his family sat quietly at our table until my father pulled his mother onto the dance floor, and soon all of his relations were drinking rum and waving their hands in the air as they rocked their hips. Melinda and I stole away for a private moment. We sat near the water's edge, waves lapping at our toes. We shared a cigarette. I can't believe he won you over. She leaned into me, bumping me with her shoulder. He's quite bearable once he stops being Mr. Hollywood. Melinda sighed. How did you manage that? She waved tiredly toward the reception. I keep dating men who can never turn that off. I took a long drag. I made it quite clear from the start that I wasn't remotely interested in where he could take me or who he knows. Once that was settled, he was very easy to love. She began to move damp sand into a small pile. When she was done, she pulled her knees to her chest, resting her cheek against her legs. Don't let each other go, she said. We honeymooned on a private island off the coast. There were no televisions, few tourists, lots of time for stretching our bodies in the sun and getting browner and drinking too much and eating too much. I told him if I found his cell phone, which is one of his vital organs, I would jump up and down on it. He believed me. I'm small, but I have big feet. He made me a small boat out of palm fronds and a pointed hat I wore to dinner. We sucked on sugarcane until the insides of our mouths shriveled. I buried him in the hot sand and teased him by lying atop the mound of his body, flicking my tongue against his ear. Fabien, one of the boys who worked at the resort, took a fancy to me. Campbell pretended to be jealous as Fabien followed me around. When my husband looked away, Fabien flirted aggressively, leaning into me with his shoulders, dancing his fingertips along my arm. He seemed harmless. He had bright, shining eyes. Campbell and I laughed about it when I told him. One night, Campbell lay across the bed, his lips slick with rum. We wanted to cool our drinks and our skin, so I grabbed the ice bucket and walked to the main building. My body hummed with joy. On my way back, Fabien grabbed me by the waist, tried to dance with me. Ice cubes spilled onto the warm pavement. "What are you doing with the American?" he asked. His hand slid down to my ass and he squeezed, pressing himself against me. His chest was a flat, hard stretch of muscle. I smiled and twisted away. I tried to laugh. I said, "No, no, no. I'm a married woman, but you are very kind." He tried to kiss me. His lips were salty and thin. I shrieked and bit his lower lip, hard. He cursed, scooping a fallen ice cube from the ground and holding it to his bloody lip. I ran back to our cottage, clutching the ice bucket to my chest. Campbell looked up as I came into the room and slammed the door behind me. My hands shook as I locked the door and set the ice on the dresser and crawled into bed next to him. He asked what took me so long. I stared up at the ceiling fan. "You're a beautiful woman," says Maria. Her words are slower now. My mind is slower now. My aunt must be wondering where I am. In the morning, she will nag me incessantly about where I was, what I was doing. Maria traces my shoulder with one finger. I don't pull away. "You are a mystery to your family," she says. "I feel like I know you." She presses her lips to the bone of my chin. This time, I pull away. I'm a married woman. Maria takes a long sip of wine, her teeth clinking against the glass. "I have a husband back home. I hardly remember his face," she sighs. "It is lonely here." I ignore the tightening in my chest. "It is lonely everywhere." Maria kisses a gentle line from my forehead to my ear. I stand and go to the window, smeared with a thin layer of grease and fingerprints. I have no idea what is happening. I don't understand my role in it. Down on the street, a young couple argues, the man pacing back and forth along the length of a bus bench, while the woman sits on the back of the bench, her feet tapping against the seat. I press two fingers against the window pane. "I suppose we both think we know each other," I say. For the rest of our honeymoon, Fabien lurked. His smile was colder, his eyes not so bright. Campbell and I went back to the mainland and rejoined my parents. We sat in the courtyard of my father's house and told them we had a lovely honeymoon. Heat rose up my neck and through my face as I thought of how night after night, our naked bodies pressed together frantically beneath the mosquito netting, how my husband made me wild for him. Sitting with my parents, Campbell reached for my hand. I laced my fingers through his. There was a popular market at the center of the capital. On our last day, my husband wanted to see this market. He wanted to be among my new people. I rolled my eyes but indulged him. The sun was high, the air so thick we had to push it out of the way to take a step forward. We walked slowly, sweat beading along the edges of our faces, our clothes clinging damply. My husband bought me an ice flavored with grenadine and oranges. I threw bits of ice at his neck. When we came upon a stall of pirated DVDs, he became absorbed. I grew bored. I pressed my hand into the small of his back and said I was going to keep walking. Every few minutes I turned back to find him, and he waved his arm high above his head, grinning. The last time I turned back, he held a stack of movies in his hand, gave me a thumbs up. A new swarm of people started milling between us, their bodies making the distance seem impossible. I continued walking, idly touching woven rugs and boxes of cornflakes and Levi's jeans. I did not see the man who grabbed me, but at the end of the row of stalls, I saw Fabien standing square, staring right at me, his lips curled into a small smile. Before I could make a sound, the man covered my mouth with a hand so large it practically covered the whole of my face. I had no idea what was happening. I did not understand my place in that moment. I kicked, tried to scratch my way free, but there was little I could do. People saw me being taken. Some shook their heads, offered their pity, most looked away. I did not see my husband until 3 days later. We decided to have the wedding on my island because a reporter on CNN said the country was safer now, said the beaches were once again full of pale American tourists, Canadians too. The troubles, the reporter said, would soon be a distant memory. We believed him because I thought it would be wonderful to marry the man I loved on the soil of the country I loved before I learned how to love anything else. I was returned to my family in the early morning, when the air was almost cool and the sky was dark gray like Campbell's eyes. I sat in the back of a pickup truck holding on to the rusted edge as the broken roads tossed me from side to side. My kidnappers didn't say a word as they lifted me out of the truck bed and set me on the ground. With a light shove, they pushed me toward my father's house and drove off, gravel spitting from their tires. I shivered as I knocked softly. I waited. In the distance, a rooster crowed mournfully. When no one answered, I knocked harder, wincing because my knuckles were tender. Finally, my husband answered, his eyes widening. He spread his arms open and he said, "Oh, my God." I planted my hand against his chest and pushed him away. I refused to look in his face and slid past him, locked myself in our room. I leaned against the door as he knocked. He was soon joined by my parents, the three of them pounding their fists against the door, trying to break it down to reach me, pleading for me to let them in. "Please be quiet," I said. "I need to think. Please, let me think." When I was ready, I took a deep breath and opened the door. They spoke fast. I couldn't hold on to their words. Nothing happened. A group of men grabbed me from the market and took me to a sugar warehouse on the edge of the city. They left me alone. I looked at Campbell. "When you paid the ransom, they brought me here." My husband shook his head slowly. "Baby," he said. "Baby." He clasped my shoulder gently and turned me toward a full-length mirror on the wall. I did not know who I was looking at. The woman in the mirror. Her face swelled with dark bruises. The corner of her lip was split and angry. Her tank top was torn along the waist in several places. Her jeans were soiled. I shook my head. Nothing happened. Maria joins me at the window. "It is so strange," she says, "living in a place with so much steel and concrete. All these buildings, they don't even seem real." I shrug. "Do you have children?" I ask, turning around. Maria shakes her head and returns to the couch, the cushion beneath her sighing. "Not yet." I hold my hand against my chest and swallow. "I have a son. He is 3. Maria coughs. "Your family did not mention you have a child." "Haven't you learned, Maria? My family doesn't know anything about me." The captain of the local precinct came to the house immediately. I told him I had no information to help him find my kidnappers. He appeared grateful, but spoke of an investigation that would be ongoing, how justice would be served. He drank my father's coffee and ate sweet cake, his shoulders slumped. There was nothing he could do, no matter what I told him, no matter what he said. I excused myself as my parents and husband and the captain spoke and made empty statements about the cruelty of the world. I locked myself in the bathroom, filled the tub with hot water, and sank into it, watching as the water turned pink, the dried blood on my body dissolving slowly. I closed my eyes and sank beneath the surface. The rush of heavy silence overwhelmed me until it comforted me. When Campbell found me, I was sitting on our bed, drying my hair with a towel. "You need to see a doctor," he said, sitting next to me. I slid away, but I didn't mean to. I said, "I am a doctor." Later that afternoon, we were on a charter flight to Manhattan, where a friend of mine from medical school had privileges at Beth Israel. The plane was well-appointed, leather seats, lacquered services, and alcohol I drank liberally. My skin and muscle and bone hurt. We were silent for a long while. I did not look out the window. Finally, I cleared my throat. "It shouldn't be too difficult to get an annulment." Campbell's face rearranged into a hard line. "What the hell are you talking about?" He slammed his fist against the wall. "What the hell are you talking about?" It was the first and only time he has raised his voice to me. His anger filled the cabin until there was no air. A loud ringing made my ears ache. I started shaking. He covered my hand with his. "You are my wife," he said. "You are safe with me." I closed my eyes and opened them again. When I was working crazy shifts during my residency, Campbell brought me coffee, hot food, his smile. We went up to the roof and sat on a pair of lawn chairs. We'd hold hands. Many times he pushed me to the ground, pulling my scrubs down around my ankles, taking me as I stared into the starry night sky, and held on to him as tightly as I could. He whispered, "I love you so much," into the skin of my neck as I rose to meet him. On the plane that day, I said, "I can't breathe. I can't do anything." I leaned against him, pressing my forehead against the strength of his arm. I held his wrists so he wouldn't wrap his arms around me. He whispered into the skin of my neck. Maria and I open yet another bottle of wine. I don't remember the last time I drank this much, or I do. My body feels loose, like every part of me is falling away. My son is very smart, I say, only 3 years old, and he knows so much. I saw it in his eyes from the day he was born that he would know lots of important things. I cross my legs, bouncing my foot. He has a sweet tooth, just like my grandmother. If you give him candy, he will love you all his life. He is perfect. Maria nods and smiles. Why didn't you bring him? She is skeptical. I study the painting on the wall above the television, geometric shapes and metallic colors surrounding a woman carrying a woven basket on her head. That isn't possible. Is it hard to be away from your husband? Maria slides a hand between my thighs. She kisses my shoulder and my neck and my cheek and brushes her lips across mine. I find ways to keep from being terribly lonely. I sit perfectly still. When we arrived at the hospital, my friend Natalia was waiting at the entrance. I held on to my husband's arm and walked slowly. She ushered us into an examination room. I stood in the corner. Campbell tried to sit down. I looked at Natalia and shook my head. She smiled and told him he should go to the waiting room. I'm not leaving you, he said. I held on to the wall to steady myself. I don't want you to see me differently. He closed his fingers into tight fists. That could never happen. My knees were on the verge of buckling. He reached for me. You're shaking, Campbell said. I tried to back away. Don't touch me. I was hysterical, barely coherent. My husband paled. You're afraid of me. Natalia gently took hold of his elbow and pulled him out of the room. I wanted to call out to him, but my throat locked. I was mute. Later, he would tell me he waited just outside the door the entire time. I would have known, even if he hadn't told me. Natalia returned. Alone at last, she said. She's the amiable sort, the one everyone got along with, even the med students with claws. You came to the right person. You're going to get through this. I half laughed, then covered my mouth to catch an ugly sob. My face was wet, my lips salty. Natalia wrapped her arms around me and smoothed my hair over and over. She said, shh. I allowed myself to fall into her. Later, after the examination, after the revolting terror of my body revealing the truth of what happened, after needles in my arm taking my blood from me, after large pills I struggled to swallow down my raw, aching throat, after stitches on my face, my chest, in places I did not know could be stitched, after my wrist, x-rays of which revealed fractures and sharp relief, was splinted and wrapped in a cast, Natalia said, I am not going to say anything, but I'm sorry this happened to you, and you can talk to me if you want, need, anything you need. I wanted to tell her, to tell anyone, but the words thickened on my tongue and stayed there, rotting slowly. Maria slides her hand beneath my shirt, pressing the palm of her hand against my navel. Her hand is surprisingly cool. I exhale slowly. She slides her hand higher. Just before she cups my breast, I grab her wrist and push her hand away. I am happily married, I say. Maria nips the fleshy part of my earlobe. As am I. This time, I push her away roughly, stand, and look for my jacket. You have no right. I would have thought you might appreciate the touch of a woman after everything. You don't know anything about me. Nothing happened. I understand why that version of the truth suits you. A hot rush of anger suddenly fills my mouth. I pull Maria up from the couch and force her hand to my crotch. Is this what you want? Your family is right. You are a very cold woman, Maria says. Only to people who don't know me. We did not stay in New York long. I wanted to go home. Melinda was waiting in our loft. I hadn't spoken since the hospital. Campbell was out of his mind trying to fix me. Melinda gasped when she saw me, stood and held her hands open. I do not know what to say. My face was frozen, muscles locked. I couldn't look her in the eye. She hasn't spoken in 2 days, Campbell said. I walked past them to the balcony and stood alone in the waning light. When Melinda joined me, I refused to turn around. I studied the scenery below and took long drags on my cigarette. When our eyes finally met, all she could say was, "Oh, honey." I didn't make sense of it at first. I couldn't keep food down. I assumed my body was trying to recover. 4 months after our honeymoon, the last of the bruises finally faded, I was back at work. Campbell made me pancakes on a Saturday morning while I sat quietly on the kitchen counter. I asked for one and he handed it to me on the spatula. I grinned as I pulled the warm pancake apart. He smiled back. I reached for him with my feet and pulled him between my legs. I fed him bits of pancake. I let him hold me for the first time since our honeymoon. "Look at you," Campbell whispered into my neck. I kissed his double chin, his lips, shyly at first, and then not so shyly. My mouth and my body remembered him. He groaned, pulling at my clothes, and I let him, but then my stomach rolled uncomfortably. I had to push him away. I ran to the bathroom, and as I heaved into the toilet, I knew, and it was the worst kind of knowing. I had taken the pills. This wasn't supposed to happen. I pounded my fist against the toilet seat. Campbell stood over me, worried. I couldn't look at him. "I need a pregnancy test." I looked up and saw how his features brightened, a wide smile stretching across his face, and then his smile became something else. I went to our room and changed. I left. I ignored my phone until the battery died. When it grew dark, I pulled into a Walmart parking lot and made sure my doors were locked. I tried to sleep. I wanted to quiet the screaming in my head. In the morning, the screaming was louder, sharper, more singular. My head throbbed. I walked into the Walmart, bought a test, and went into the bathroom where it was humid and dirty. I squatted in the last stall and held the stick between my thighs. I gritted my teeth and pissed. I didn't need to look at the readout to know it would read yes. I find my coat and thank Maria for the dinner. It has been a long, strange evening. She is nervous as she unlocks her front door. "Please don't tell your family about this." I brush my finger across her knuckles. "I don't tell my family anything." It is much colder outside, but I walk slowly. The streets are empty, which scares me. In the 4 years since our honeymoon, I have always been scared. I have felt a spiraling terror lodged in my throat. I have tried to cut that terror out. I found my husband sitting in the hall entrance of our loft. He hadn't shaved. His eyes were wild with anger and something else. He looked up at me, and when he spoke, his voice was uncomfortably calm. "After what happened, I would think you would be considerate enough to call if you aren't coming home." I stepped toward him, then stopped. I didn't realize," I said. I didn't think." "Your pancakes are cold." I handed him the pregnancy test. "It could be yours." He patted the floor next to him, and I slowly lowered myself to the floor. "Tell me what happened. If I know, I can help you. I can try." "Do you want to know, or do you need to know?" Campbell cracked his knuckles. "I want, because it's what's best for you." Once again, my throat locked. I shook my head. I sit on the cold concrete steps of my aunt's stoop and call Campbell. I am very drunk. "Can you come out here?" I ask, my words slurring. "What's wrong?" His voice is dry and hoarse. "I have a son, Campbell." It feels good to release those words from my chest again. "Yes, we do." That is the perfect thing to say. It's the truth. I had too much to drink, and a woman hit on me and tried to kiss me. It was weird. "And I didn't get to watch?" His voice is clearer now. I laugh. "You're a pig." "Are you okay? Did you kiss her back?" "Yeah, a little, no tongue. I really drank a lot." "You are so LA now." "I miss our son every time I breathe. I miss you." I can hear Campbell moving now. I'm ready to make another baby. I close my eyes. The phone grows warmer against my cheek. Are you there? I didn't mean anything by that. I'm ready too, I say softly. The paternity test confirmed my worst fears. I couldn't get rid of it, old country ways, and knew I couldn't keep it.